Welcome to the Symphony Space in New York City. We are here with a sold-out audience for an Intelligence Squared U.S. debate in which the motion is Bush 43 is the worst president of the last 50 years. I'm John Donvan, your host and moderator, and tonight we have, arguing for the motion, Jacob Weisberg, who is editor-in-chief of Slate and author of The Bush Tragedy. Joining him on the same team, Simon Jenkins, a distinguished British newspaper editor and commentator. Karl Rove, former deputy chief of staff to President Bush. And his debating partner, Bill Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard and chief of staff for former Vice President Dan Quayle. This evening is a contest. You are the judges. We are going to poll you twice during the program, once now and once later. We want to poll you to see where you stand on the motion. We'll come to those results shortly after we hear the opening statements from the panelists. Arguing first for the motion is Jacob Weisberg. He has just published a book, A History of the Bush Family in Politics. Its title gives you a sense of where he's coming from on this debate. It is called The Bush Tragedy. Ladies and gentlemen, Jacob Weisberg.
Let me first just tell you a little bit about my own perspective on this. I am not a Bush hater. I'm not someone who can be described as a partisan Democrat the way Mr. Kristol and Mr. Rove are partisan Republicans. And let me just state up front, I think George W. Bush was a fine governor of Texas. And I think George H.W. Bush, 41, understood foreign policy better than all but a few presidents in the post-war era. About 2 years ago, I started writing a book about the Bush presidency. And I was going to spend a lot of time on Bush's successes and accomplishments. There were a number of areas where I expected to stick up for Bush, but I really found it impossible. For example, I was sympathetic to his approach to education reform. But even from a conservative perspective, Bush didn't provide enough resources to allow for any real mobility or choice. Instead of national standards, which we needed, he let the states write their own tests. I thought Bush was right about the need for immigration reform. And then I watched him surrender to the xenophobes and nativists in his own party. I thought Bush was right to spend a lot of money fighting AIDS in Africa. And then I watched him save far fewer lives than he might have because of religious extremists, again in his own party, who believe abstinence propaganda is more effective than condoms. I thought Bush was right about free trade, and then I watched his lack of leadership lead to the collapse of the most important item on the global trade agenda, the Doha Development Route. And I can't hope to cover all Bush's failures tonight. What would be a top failure for another president doesn't even really make his top five. Number one is the invasion of Iraq. Now, I'm not someone who believes that Bush deliberately falsified the evidence, but I believe he was totally uninterested in the evidence. I think his second biggest failure is the mismanaged occupation of Iraq. Bush refused for more than 3 years to change a failed military strategy. And almost that whole time, people like my friend Mr. Kristol here were desperately insisting, rightly in my view, that Bush needed to move to a counterinsurgency strategy. Bush said, essentially, don't bother me with the details. His third biggest failure is undermining constitutional rights. Now, I can't go into detail here about all the ways he abused his authority, but he and Vice President Cheney opened the door to torture, which led directly to the horrors of Abu Ghraib. He effectively suspended habeas corpus, holding suspects for years without charge or trial, and he took a perverse view of his office, claiming that virtually limitless executive authority was part of the inherent power of the presidency. His fourth failure was sabotaging American unity after September 11th. The day after the attacks, the front page of Le Monde in Paris said, "We're all Americans." But Mr. Bush and Mr. Rove saw September 11th as a political opportunity for what Spiro Agnew called positive polarization. Number five, my last, is Bush's catastrophic economic mismanagement. This is so current we hardly even need to spell it out. But I think it's clear that we're living through the direct result of an ideological refusal to sensibly regulate financial markets. Now, our opponents this evening may try to argue that Richard Nixon or Jimmy Carter was worse. Neither of them rivals Bush for sheer, all-pervading incompetence. But if our opponents tonight... I'm closing here. If our opponents tonight wish to argue that Bush was only the second worst president of the last 50 years, that's not much of a defense. This national nightmare, I would suggest, has been the deepest and longest of all.
Bill Kristol is the editor of the influential Washington-based political magazine, The Weekly Standard. Just over a year ago, he wrote a piece predicting that President Bush's presidency would be remembered ultimately by history as a successful one. We bumped into each other on the street last week, and he said, "I'm still prepared to argue that, but can I leave out the U.S. economy?" Bill Kristol, ladies and gentlemen.
As we sit here safely 7 years after 9/11, having won a war in Iraq, we can snicker and laugh with the U.S. economy having grown 18% over the last 8 years, faster than any other Western advanced country, with the prescription drug benefit having been passed that has benefited many seniors, for which Bush gets no credit at all, which he took on his own party for. Bush has actually been a pretty impressive president. When he became president, al-Qaeda was ascendant. Saddam Hussein was contained, but unsustainably so, unless you think we could have had sanctions and inspectors for the last 8 years. North Korea and Iran were secretly working on nuclear weapons programs. AQ Khan was dispensing nuclear material and know-how all over the world. Then 9/11. Bush reacted to that correctly, basically. Jack Goldsmith, Attorney General Ashcroft, Attorney General Mukasey have fixed some of the mistakes that were made under the pressure of trying to defend this country against a ruthless terrorist group that had taken 3,000 lives. History will look kindly on Bush's performance as a national security and homeland security president. And one piece of the proof is that Obama is not going to change much. As the Obama people get briefed on the threats, they see that the surveillance program is necessary. I suppose Obama will close Guantanamo and move, in effect, Guantanamo here to the United States, put the people at Fort Leavenworth, but he's not going to release these people into the U.S. The enhanced interrogation techniques, which McCain and Obama opposed, so I guess I'm a lonely person in defending those, saved an awful lot of lives when used on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and I'm not willing to second-guess the decision. The Middle East today, with Saddam in power, or his sons in power, with terror connections, redeveloping the weapons of mass destruction programs, presumably, would have been a much more dangerous place. The decision to go with the surge was a courageous decision with very little public support, very little support from the Republican establishment, no support, obviously, from almost any Democrats except Joe Lieberman. It was the right decision. It's been utterly vindicated. Bush said, "Let's do this. Here's what will happen. Here's how it will work." The critics said it can't work. It wasn't working. And now Barack Obama, of course, being an intelligent person, admits that the surge worked, and we are now beginning to draw down in a position of success in Iraq. The degree to which Bush does not get enough credit for refusing to cut and run in 2007 in Iraq, the degree to which people don't appreciate the geostrategic disaster that would have been, it remains kind of amazing to me. The rest of Bush's foreign policy has been, I have my quarrels with some of it, but most of it's been pretty successful. The relationship with India, the management of the China and Japan relationships. On the economy, obviously that's been terrible in the last few months. I do think Bush could have done some things differently, but to be fair, it's not as if the Democrats had one prescription and Bush had another. We did have economic growth over these 8 years. On the other hand, the big piece of deregulation that everyone loves to cite, the key that unlocked that was presumably the 1999 deregulation of financial institutions signed by Bill Clinton. So it's a little ridiculous to say Bush is the worst president in 50 years, Barack Obama is an intelligent, impressive man, but the fact of the matter is Obama's presidency will be in most major respects a continuation of the Bush presidency, and that's a good thing for the country.
Simon Jenkins is a journalist and an author and writes a column for The Guardian. He is a British subject. He is a friend of America, but has never hesitated to tell America when it thinks it has made mistakes. Ladies and gentlemen, Simon Jenkins arguing for the motion.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I just heard a wonderful suggestion. Barack Obama is going to be the second worst president since the war. The only thing I think that might make you, or many of you at least, not agree that George Bush is the worst American president in 50 years is to hear somebody say it in a British accent. There is something about foreign accents on these subjects that gets people's backs up, so I beg your pardon. When George Bush came to power, I was rather in favour of him. I rather admired the programme he put forward for his foreign policy. I liked the remark about America setting the world an example by what it did at home rather than by getting the 82nd Airborne to lead kids to school. Then came 9/11. And I've always remembered those few weeks after 9/11 when the whole world was pro-American. Yasser Arafat gave blood for New Yorkers. Almost nobody was not on America's side for those two or three weeks. And the disaster that followed, going to war, has something from which I don't think American policy abroad has ever recovered. I've recently been touring around that arc of instability. To pretend that Iraq is a success is obscene. Iraq today is more or less back to what it was like in 2004. Afghanistan is heading in exactly the same direction. I think Afghanistan's going to be a far worse mistake than Iraq. But in every single theater that you look, you will see what I can only describe as the wrong decisions taken. Iran should not be a foe of America at the moment. It should be much more like Egypt, and it could have been. There's no reason for undermining the Pakistan government to the extent that it's been undermined by American military intervention there. Now, those of us who feel very strongly about America always regarded the basis on which America operated out of its area, America went abroad to do things, was that it had a sort of moral superiority. There was behind what it did a backbone. I'm afraid under the leadership of the last 8 years, that backbone has snapped. If you go around the world today, you will find the most extraordinary faith in the person you've elected as your next president. I have never come across anything like it. A totally naive belief that this is the Messiah, Barack Obama, has come to save not you, but everybody. Ludicrous expectations are placed on the shoulders of this man. The reason why I think unrealistic but possibly disastrous expectations are made of Barack Obama is that George Bush, for better or for worse, George Bush has caused such a catastrophe in so many countries around the world. I congratulate you on voting for Obama. I hope you will vote for this motion. Thank you.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores. Our motion is, Bush 43 is the worst president of the last 50 years. On the side against the motion, someone very close to the issue, Karl Rove. Stay with us.
Karl Rove has been a member of President Bush's political family since President Bush first decided to go into politics. That goes back more than two decades. He is known as the architect of the 2000 and 2004 victories. Ladies and gentlemen, Karl Rove.
I'm going to make an appeal to the open-minded people of the Upper West Side. And for those of you sensitive to sulfur and brimstone, I apologize. Nothing I can do about it. I'd like to spend my time talking about the drive-bys we just saw. We saw a drive-by on No Child Left Behind. Sure, we said states should set standards. We didn't say one national standard because we wanted the people in New York and the people in New Mexico to be engaged in setting standards for their states and to be involved in setting up a system that they would buy into. And in the 5 years since No Child Left Behind has come into force around this country, which requires every state to set standards, we have seen more improvement in reading and math and science scores in those 5 years than we've seen in the 28 previous years combined. And the scores have gone up most among the minority communities, black and brown and poor and rural. We heard about immigration with a line that said somehow or another the president threw in with the immigration restrictionist. You know what? I don't think that bill we brought to the floor of the United States Senate was an immigration restrictionist bill. It was a bill that resolved the problem in a comprehensive way, and the president showed courage by standing for it and making it possible. PEPFAR. I heard a dismissal of this incredible effort by the generosity of the American people that is today providing over 2 million people in Africa with life-saving retroviral drugs. Now, sure, we insist upon encouraging programs to educate people about abstinence and faithfulness within marriage and how those can help break the cycle of the spread of AIDS. And it's working. And free trade. I love this one. I sat there and was part of the team that bled to win Trade Promotion Authority. And you know how many votes we won it by? One. We got CAFTA, which was a no-brainer. Do you know how many votes we got it by? One. I sat there in that room, in the cabinet room, with 22 Democrats who voted for NAFTA and China and TPA under Clinton, who could not bring themselves to vote for free trade under this president. Why? Politics. So I appreciate the enthusiasm that some of our adversaries here in tonight's debate have for free trade, and I'm looking forward to working with them in common cause on behalf of every free trade measure that comes before the United States Congress. And why don't we make a pact that will start with Colombia? Why don't we do that? Now, about that invasion of Iraq, I appreciated hearing about how it was done on a false premise, and hearing those words come from the mouth of somebody who wrote eloquently about the need to remove Saddam Hussein from power. Appreciate your support at the time. Nice of you to flip-flop now. Easy to flip-flop now. Look, do we wish we'd had the weapons were there and it was justified under those terms? Yeah. You know what? You know what, though? Smart people like Bill Clinton and Al Gore and John Kerry sat on the floor of the Congress or at the White House in the 90s or in the Congress in the 2000s and said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Talk about the mismanagement of the economy. The Dow down 38%. The NASDAQ down 78%. The S&P down 50%. $6 trillion lost in value in 1 year. I'm talking about March 2000, when the market started to go down and bottomed out in October of 2002. Thank God this president had the wherewithal and the political capital and the moxie to pass a large, effective stimulus package of $1.6 trillion over 10 years that got the economy growing again by long-lasting tax cuts that benefited everybody in America who pays taxes. And Iran, it's somehow our fault, Bush's fault, that the Ayatollahs and the mullahs and the lunatics are pursuing a nuclear weapon in Iran. I think that has to do with their decision to pursue a nuclear weapon, not us making them do it. I loved it being lectured about undermining the government of Pakistan. After all, haven't we just elected a president who had promised to invade Pakistan if it didn't comply with America's wishes? Now, look, I will defend the president, and I will defend the record of the last 8 years. Not always successful, but enormously successful over the long term and the long sweep of history.
Carl Rove,
thank you for
very
having
much.
Me here tonight.
Thank you, Carl Rove. And that concludes the opening statements. In a minute or two, we're going to come to you, the audience. But we now have the numbers that tell us your opinions as you came in off the streets tonight. Bush 43 is the worst president of the last 50 years. 65% of you are for the motion, 17% against, and 18% undecided. We tend to judge success in this debate by how much you can actually move those numbers. So if that 65% goes up, the side four will have prevailed. If the 17% that is against goes up, that side will be seen to have prevailed.
I demand a recount.
Anyone ready with questions just yet?
This is a question for Mr. Rove. I have great belief in the wisdom of the gross American population. If what you have said is about the Bush successes is true, how is it that his approval record is so extraordinarily and historically low?
Look, we're asking it's an unpopular war, and we're asking the country to do tough things for a long time. And the economy's bad. I would remind you, there have been three presidents who had lower approval ratings. Four. Carter, Nixon, Johnson, and Truman. History has judged each of these men differently after their departure.
Simon Jenkins, I want to bring you into a conversation. We, with Barack Obama now taking over, does the fact that he has this terrible image with which to compare himself give him a boost? Or does the fact that American leadership has been so diminished, respect for America has been so diminished, give him a terrible starting point?
Well, I think the origin of this whole part of the discussion is the response to 9/11. 9/11 is the starting point of almost everything that we've been talking about. And I think many people in Europe and indeed around the world simply feel that America overreacted. And so did Britain, I may say. It was a feeling that some new force had been unleashed on the world, to which we had to respond by restricting our normal customary defenses of liberty. The consequence of it, however, is that we have, in a sense, played the terrorist game. We've done what they wanted us to do, which was restrict our liberties, curb our liberties, behave in a certain way towards other states and other peoples that we would not normally have done before.
But I've heard Bill Kristol say, and Bill, let me bring you into this. I've heard you say that when it comes to terrorism, rather than playing the terrorist game, that the president has succeeded in putting the terrorists on the run, which is why 9/11 was the only incident in this city.
Would that they were on the run.
Bill Kristol?
Well, they haven't been very successful here, and they haven't been very successful in Western Europe, and they've actually not been very successful elsewhere. Al-Qaeda has been a losing proposition for the last several years. There remains a huge problem of a jihadist impulse in the Islamic world, which is unfortunately abetted by certain states. But I think Bush has done a pretty good, very good job of making terror a losing proposition, which is the most important thing. Bush turned that around. But I just don't buy this premise that we've radically curbed civil liberties. Bush has done less after the 9/11 attack than any other president has done, much, much less. He's been much more responsible than Franklin Roosevelt was after we were attacked in World War II. He's been much more solicitous of civil liberties than, if I might say, John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson were, and Richard Nixon were during Vietnam. There were a couple of overreactions, which the Bush administration itself walked back. Jack Goldsmith and Attorney General Mukasey have, I think, corrected some slight, some controversial interpretations that probably went
Bill, can I
too far.
One second.
Jacob Weisberg.
Jack Goldsmith was drummed out of the Bush administration for challenging those decisions, the torture
that's
memos.
He changed the actual Office of Legal Counsel policy, and Attorney General Mukasey is leaving the Bush legal program intact and,
but
I think, totally defensible, and it will not be changed much by Barack
Obama.
If
you read Goldsmith's book, he was driven out, more or less. But the point is, I'm amazed by, I appreciate how open-minded you are about some of these issues. But on the civil liberties issues, you're amazingly cavalier. Closing Guantanamo is no big deal. We have them here. We have them there. Torture, you won't second-guess the decisions. I mean, these go to the heart of the questions about the rule of law and the Constitution and the question of whether terrorist suspects...
Okay, well, what is the question?
The question...
Bush has lost fewer court decisions than almost any president has. He lost 2 5-4 decisions. Maybe the five were right. Maybe Bush shouldn't have gone quite as far as he did in some of the claims he made about Guantanamo. But we are going to have to detain people. We are not going to be able to provide them all civil trials. I do not believe that is a way you can deal with terrorists captured on the battlefield.
Why can't you deal with them with military trials? We have an existing
system of military
tribunals. No, he set up his own alternate system. We already had a system of military justice.
He signed legislation that Congress passed. Legislation that Congress passed in 2005 and 2006.
Look, it's clever to suggest that we ought to have the style of courtroom justice we provide to our military and provide that for enemy combatants. We shouldn't. That's what we've attempted to do in the military justice system, is to the greatest possible degree possible duplicate our civil justice system. And are you suggesting that we ought to Mirandize these people and keep a chain of evidence for terrorists?
Not at all. And people have far fewer rights under the military system. But the point is, under your system, they have no rights. The prisoners at Guantanamo were originally denied access to a lawyer. We couldn't even find out who was there. And the original claim by the Bush administration was that this applied to citizens as well as non-citizens. So if the Bush administration decided that you were suspected of terrorism, you could be held indefinitely without a lawyer, without a hearing, without a trial.
You know what?
I'm not saying
you're making it sound like everybody on the Upper West Side needs to worry about being sent to the re-education camps in Texas. And in reality, what it was focused at is if we picked up a U.S. citizen who was a terrorist on a battlefield abroad, would we subject them to U.S. law or would we treat them as a terrorist?
Here's what you slipped in. If we picked up someone who's a terrorist, what if they happen not to be a terrorist? Some of these people have been acquitted.
Yeah. And the system has a process of review in which that determination can
anyway,
be made.
Anyway, in the big picture, look, the fact is, in the big picture...
Name one guy you're worried about.
No, that's exactly right.
You worry about John Lynn? You worry about him? What person
was
you
the Bush
administration
about? Bad at explaining their policies, especially abroad? Yes. Did people abroad take a kind of cavalier and really... hypocritical sense of pleasure in decrying those ridiculous Americans with all this stuff when they themselves, of course, as you know well, in continental Europe treat their own citizens with many less rights, are much, much nastier to their own minorities. Bush went out of his way and with great success to say this is not a war on Islam. We need to respect everyone's rights. Muslim Americans here have a much fairer and more equal playing field than Muslims do in most of these wonderful European countries that sit around having heart attacks. About 200 people held
Simon,
at Guantanamo.
Simon Jenkins.
What I think is extraordinary to people abroad is that those of us who are enthusiasts for America and American liberties cannot see why you needed to do these things. You will never persuade the outside world that you have not restricted liberty in America. You will never persuade them that you have not taken out Muslims as a particular group. And you'll never persuade them that you really needed to do these things.
What have we done to Muslims in America? What has happened?
Arrested them.
We've arrested Muslims in America?
Incarcerated them without trial.
Name one instance.
But the lobbyists belabor me all day with lists of people who have vanished. Vanished.
This is on the border of lunacy, with all due respect.
All right, let's come back to some questions.
I see down in the front row.
You've got the world believing America is a less robust place than it really is.
Now, what part of the world is that? Is that China and India? Do they have? I'm serious. Let's talk about the world. The world turns out to be a certain class of liberal elites in Western Europe. Not all of Western. It does. Is America unpopular in East Asia? Is America unpopular? Has Bush's policy towards China been terrible in terms of the Chinese views? India is a great success story, a rather important, huge democracy for Bush, even in Western Europe.
I want to go to questions. First row.
This is for Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Weisberg. If President Bush had not decided to go to war with Iraq and had only decided to go to war with Afghanistan to fight terrorism, do you think Saddam Hussein would have, A, remained a neutral and impartial observer in the war between Islamic terrorists in the West, B, allied with the United States in an effort to stamp out Islamic terrorists and bring democracy to Afghanistan, or C, grown a dangerous supporter and protector of Islamic terrorists, including al-Qaeda and others?
Simon and Jacob, why don't you take that?
Well, we have a problem here. I just don't see terrorism as a state projected force in the way that you do. I regard it in the sense that the question was trying to ask before, as a criminal act of gangsters roaming the world and badly in need of curtailing by their own governments. I think the way we treated international terrorism is to glorify it, to give it the status of a state. We've given huge recruiting energy to those people who want to bring young people into this particular odious fold. And I think by declaring war on some governments, I may say not all governments that harbour them, we've accorded them a status wholly beyond what they deserve. I just think we've overdone it. And in overdoing it, we've turned very large numbers of countries, particularly in the Islamic world, into state menaces. They themselves are undermined by the status we've given to these people, Pakistan being a classic case of that. This is quite a cosmic question. If you declare a very small group of people to be an international menace, you turn them into a sort of hero, and we've done that, and it's been a terrible, terrible mistake.
Mr. Rove mentioned somewhere in that incredible litany of distortions that that I was in favor of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. I was, as were a lot of sensible people. I didn't happen to favor doing it the way Bush did, largely unilaterally, rejecting allies as opposed to building pressure on Saddam and not waiting for the inspection process to play out. But I think the point is, and what we've subsequently learned, and the problem I had that Bush didn't have was I did not have access to analysts from the Department of Energy trying to tell everybody that those aluminum tubes were not for nuclear weapons. But the point is that Saddam had been successfully disarmed and was being successfully contained. And he was not supporting international terrorism because he was afraid to. He was a miscalculator, a serial miscalculator, but he was not a madman. And I think he understood very clearly that supporting terrorism against the United States would have resulted in the same thing that happened anyway, his destruction.
Question from Mr. Rove and Mr. Crystal. Who is the worst president of the last 50 years and why?
Lyndon Johnson probably made the worst mistake, perhaps, of the last 50 years with Vietnam, but he also deserves a huge amount of credit, I think, in terms of certainly civil rights, and I would say something like Medicare. So people are not, you know, univocally good or bad. I do think, I'd say in terms of personal corruption of the political system of the judicial system and of the governmental system for political ends, clearly Nixon. And I would say in terms of just incompetence and leaving the country in dangerous shape, which had to be reversed, Carter. So the 70s was a bad decade, in my opinion, for American presidents and for America and for the world, which was reversed by Reagan.
I'm going to go to a question down front row.
The question is for Mr. Rove. Had the intelligence been accurate prior to the invasion of Iraq, would the invasion have still taken place, in your view?
No. In the aftermath of 9/11, the concern was about a tyrant guilty of enormous human rights abuses, but possessed with weapons of mass destruction and an intention to use them as a state sponsor of terror. Absent that, I suspect the administration's course would have been to work to find more creative ways to constrain him than he had been constrained in the 90s. The president did have an enormous concern about the human rights abuses under Saddam Hussein. He also had a concern about the deterioration of the credibility of the United Nations, which had passed 16 resolutions calling upon him to abide by the outcome and the agreements that he made in the aftermath of the 91, of the first Gulf War, that he had not lived up to. But absent weapons of mass destruction, no, I don't think there would have been an invasion.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores. Our motion is, Bush 43 is the worst president of the last 50 years. On the side against the motion, someone very close to the issue, Karl Rove. Stay with us.
We're heading down the home stretch on questions from the audience. One second, let's see what we have in the back.
The statement has been made that we have been made safer because of President Bush's administration since September 11th. If he is to receive credit, is he to receive blame for not protecting us for September 11th?
Bill Kristol?
I think the Bush administration would say, I mean, I think Condi Rice and others have said this, that they now wish, of course, they had been more alarmed and more alert as they had taken office in those first few months. So, yes, there's blame to go around on 9/11. But fundamentally, the growth of al-Qaeda, the ability of al-Qaeda, which was key to have the terror training camps unmolested in Afghanistan, is not something that primarily happened under Bush.
But can we just one more word on this? Because if you read Richard Clark's book or some of the other inside accounts of this, it's clear it's not that nobody had heard of al-Qaeda. Richard Clark, for example, was running around with his hair on fire about how dangerous this threat was. And it's clear that Bush in the early days downplayed it, rejected it, didn't take it seriously, and did so because it had been a particular focus of the Clinton administration, and he was reversing policy.
If it was a particular focus of the, if it was such a focus of the Clinton administration, it would be nice to know exactly what they did about it. Since,
well, they,
Richard Clark himself,
they launched missile strikes.
Well, they launched one series of pointless
missile
strikes.
Bush hasn't got them either. They started a little later, anyway.
In the last 50 years, this administration has been by far the biggest spending administration, with the possible exception of Lyndon Johnson, and that's even before spending on Homeland Security and Iraq. What is your response to that?
Look, I like how, first of all, you did put aside Homeland Security. Let's take a look at discretionary domestic spending. The last budget left to us, the FY01 budget, left to us by that previous president, whose name you can fill in, increased discretionary domestic spending in FY01 15% in 1 year. We cut in our first budget, FY02, discretionary domestic spending to 7%, in FY03 to 4%, in FY05, 2%, and 6, 7, and 8 have flatlined discretionary domestic spending of the government. It's been hard to do. We're going to leave an enormous benefit in place for Barack Obama in that we have flatlined discretionary domestic spending.
No, and the biggest spending item apart is two things, the tax cuts. We can debate economic policy, but I think an awful lot of people think, especially the 2003 tax cuts, were sensible and ended up producing actually a lot of revenue, and the prescription drug benefit, which I would defend as a conservative. Medicare exists. It is a pretty good program. It's come in under budget, and I think 92% of seniors are covered, and it seems to be working pretty well. The biggest domestic expenditure, the biggest piece of domestic legislation of the Bush administration, it did what Bush said it was going to do.
I'll take you over there first.
My question is for Mr. Jenkins or Weisberg. Please name me the difficult and courageous decisions made by Lyndon Baines Johnson and Jimmy Carter that have been proven to be the right ones, please.
All right, and up here?
To Simon and Jacob, how would you describe Bush's prosecution of the Iraq War, his rationale for the Iraq War, versus the rationale and prosecution of the Vietnam War by JFK, LBJ, and Nixon?
All right.
What differences do you see in how those two conflicts have been resolved?
Simon and Jacob, you had two questions along the lines of comparisons of George Bush to both Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, with, I think, the implication that the President's Iraq was their Vietnam. Can you take on that question?
I mean, I was a very young journalist, was in Vietnam at the very end of that war, and this is not a very well-informed comment, but my view was that the Vietnam War was far more competently executed than the occupation of Iraq. They lost, but they only just lost. I do think that America could have stabilized South Vietnam had it stayed longer. I think when you go into a country without a good reason, or with the purpose of simply punishing the country, as was the case in both Iraq and Afghanistan, you're not likely to do well because you haven't really plotted what the purpose of this exercise is. It was simply to punish. And I think it's that punitive element that's been the problem, certainly in Iraq. And I'm sorry, I've been there only twice, but I cannot accept that it is in any sense of the word a success.
Jacob?
Just on LBJ, the questioner asked, what courageous thing did he ever do? Just for starters, how about saying goodbye to the South, the Democratic Party, for generations when he signed the Civil Rights Act in 64 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965? Johnson knew that would be the political consequence of that decision, and he did it anyway. To me, that's almost a definition of political courage. On judgment, however, I don't think Johnson does so well in Vietnam, and I think it's quite comparable to Bush. I think both of them were very poor. I think both of them were essentially unable to admit error, to recognize error, and to reverse error. And whereas Johnson, it was a slightly different story, and you know, you get into sort of psychological territory here, but Johnson clearly didn't trust Kennedy's advisors. He had this long-standing issue with the Kennedy brothers, and I think he was getting some good advice from some of the Kennedy people, but I think he couldn't hear it because who was giving it. And likewise with Bush on Iraq, certainly the advice he got from Colin Powell at the very beginning not to invade Iraq was very good advice, but I think Bush was so blinded by his own motives, whatever you think they were, that I think he effectively couldn't hear that. You know, it finally took just a series. It got to the point, really, where there was a total consensus that the strategy was failed and that Rumsfeld was failing. And I think Bush postponed change until there was absolutely no choice.
Okay, we're coming down to our last few minutes of questions, and I would like to make it a little bit forward-looking, and I just want to see if any of the hands up here have questions related to what President-elect Obama inherits from President Bush. Is anybody thinking along those lines quite clearly? And don't snooker me, because I'll squash your question if it's...
I, for one, am proud of the job President Bush has done to keep us safe and, in turn, the world. With that said, Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Weisberg, what would you suggest that Barack Obama now do with Islamofascism, and how is that different from the current policies that the Bush administration is employing?
Jacob.
I think Obama should focus, as he's appropriately doing, on Afghanistan and how to turn around a deteriorating situation there. I think he should figure out how to get us out of Iraq without Iraq falling back into the situation it was before the surge. You know, much of this is so invisible to us that it's very hard when we say Bush has kept us safe. It's true, we have not had another terrorist attack in the United States. How much of that is the result of policy? How much is it the result of accident? We don't know that much about it. It's the dog that didn't bark. Would another president have handled it differently? I don't think so.
Simon Jenkins.
I imagine the reason why there have been no more attacks in America or in Britain or in most of Europe is because of good policing on the ground, not because you've been at war in the Middle East.
I'd like to quickly return to a question about why was America kept safe for 7 years? We're given two answers. One was luck, and the other was that any other president would have handled it the same way. Now, luck does come into play. Luck works when you have the kind of attitude that this president has, which is he's going to stay on the offense, so we fight him over there, and we're going to use every intelligence tool at our disposal to find out what they're up to. That is why we broke some of the plots that you know about publicly.
What do you mean, Carl, by fight them over there? They weren't in Iraq, unless you meant somewhere else by over there.
Well, first of all, again, I repeat, I appreciate your support for the war in Iraq at the time.
Well, I wasn't.
But let's be honest. He was supporting terrorists. This is a man who gave payments to terror bombers. This is a guy who allowed terrorist camps to organize in his country. The Ricin attack in London was launched from a camp in northeast
Iraq. This is not a nation in which you can organize a terrorist camp without the central authorities knowing about it. In the aftermath of Afghanistan and taking down the Taliban, where did Zarqawi go for medical treatment? He checked himself into the Mayo Clinic of Baghdad. You don't get that unless somebody in the government up top allows a known terrorist to seek succor and medical care in Baghdad. This was a bad actor. Did we think he had weapons of mass destruction? You bet. And I've got a sheaf load of quotes from people that you love, like Ted Kennedy and others, saying he did. He didn't. Intelligence gets it wrong both ways. In the run-up to Iraq, Muammar Gaddafi looked around and said, you know, the United States is serious about it. Britain is serious about this. I got problems. If they're willing to take out 25 million people and take on Iraq with 25 million people, they're willing to take me on. And he coughed up his weapons programs. And Western intelligence found out they were wrong. They systematically underestimated how far along his chemical and biological programs were, which were weaponized, and how far along his nuclear program, which was way beyond what anybody in Western intelligence thought he had.
What was this Ricin attack in Britain?
Jacob, Simon, the rest of the panel, save it for your summary, 2 minutes.
Milk powder.
Simon. Thanks. We're out of time on the questions and answers, but you have 2 minutes to sum up, and you can respond to the point there. I just want to thank all of you and encourage you to give yourselves a round of applause for terrific questions. We've already polled you when you came in before the debate began to see where you agree on the motion. The motion before us is Bush 43 is the worst president of the last 50 years. Before the debate, 65% of you agreed with the motion, 17% were against, 18%, one in five of you roughly, were undecided. And we're going to poll you again shortly, but now we move on to the final session of the debate in which each of the panelists has 2 minutes to summarize, and we're going to begin the summary against the motion that George W. Bush is the worst president of the last 50 years. Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard.
Look, people don't have to like Bush. Half the country voted against him in 2000 and virtually almost half in 2004. If you're a liberal, you want to approve of his domestic policies. If you think that we'd be better off not having gone into Iraq, which obviously is a debatable proposition, you could be very condemnatory of his of going into Iraq, and certainly many people have criticized the way in which we managed that war from 2004 to 2006. But to think that he's the worst president in 50 years is just silly. It's just silly, and it came out very well in the Vietnam discussion. I mean, are we being serious here? Vietnam was well run, and that was okay somehow, and, you know, Westmoreland knew what he was doing. Of course, we lost 55,000 people. We lost a war. 2 million people plus died in Vietnam and Cambodia. It was an unbelievable catastrophe. That's like Iraq, where we've lost 4,000 soldiers, where Iraq is now back on its feet, where we've won the war and established U.S. credibility and a willingness to stick to it, even though we've made terrible mistakes. And where we're actually in pretty good shape with most of the governments in the region. I myself, being more of a democracy and human rights activist, I'm a little unhappy that we're so friendly.
Bill Kristol, your time is up. 15 seconds grace.
With the governments in the region. But we are. So if we're in the real world, you can dislike George W. Bush, but you should be against this motion.
Summing up for the motion that George W. Bush is the worst American president in the last 50 years, Jacob Weisberg, author of The Bush Tragedy and editor-in-chief of the Slate Group. Jacob Weisberg.
Thank you. We've won the war in Iraq. There's something about this mission accomplished language that always makes me a little nervous. I think the damage in Iraq can be mitigated, but the war can't be vindicated as a decision. And this goes to the heart of our disagreement. Bill said at the beginning that Bush had bad choices. I don't think he had bad choices. I think he made bad choices. And I think things could have been different for Bush. I think he could have taken a different approach. And in fact, it was the approach he took when he was governor of Texas. He could have united the country and the world after September 11th. It would have given him an opportunity to be a great president. He could have reached out to the other party the way FDR did after Pearl Harbor. He could have compromised with Democrats on a whole range of issues, including climate change, expanding health care coverage, entitlement reform. He could have focused on protecting the free market instead of the interests of big business. But Bush was never up to the job of being president, and it's not a matter of lacking in intelligence. It's a matter of lacking character. Bush wasn't interested enough in policy. He couldn't tolerate challenge or dissent or disagreement. He couldn't open his mind long enough to consider alternatives or admit the possibility that he might sometimes be wrong. And in the end, I think what's so damning about Bush and what does make him the worst president of the last 50 years is that these were things within his control. And to finish, I think we can say at this point that America's great nepotistic experiment is finally coming to an end. And as my colleague Simon Jenkins has said, it's finishing not just with failure, not just with rejection, but in global disgrace.
Thank you, Jacob Weisberg. Making his summary statement against the motion that George W. Bush is the worst American president of the last 50 years, Karl Rove, former deputy chief of staff and senior advisor to George W. Bush.
Jacob's comments can be read in his book, which is a piece of fiction. To believe that George W. Bush didn't tolerate strong people in his cabinet or dissent or disagreements is ridiculous. And to suggest that he's not interested in ideas is that peculiar form of Bush hatred that causes people to lose their rational senses about the man. And this president has been on the receiving end of this kind of attitude since the moment that he took office in an election that many on the left thought was it made him an illegitimate president. Here was a man who the first person that he met with from the United States Congress was the Democrat, ranking Democrat on the House Education and Labor Committee, George Miller. Didn't cooperate and compromise with Democrats when we came out and endorsed wholesale large elements of the Joe Lieberman program for Homeland Security. Didn't compromise with Democrats when we came out for immigration reform. You know, that's just ridiculous. But I want to end because most of the circles around Iraq. Vietnam, I agree, better prosecuted than Iraq. We ended Vietnam in defeat, for which the families of 55,000 fallen heroes had reason to ask themselves whether or not that sacrifice had been made in vain. And we are coming out of Iraq with Iraq becoming a functioning, stable, semi-democracy in the heart of the Middle East, still fragile, but because of the surge, in a place today where we can see the moment that U.S. troops can come home with their honor and in victory.
Summing up, finally, for the motion that George W. Bush is the worst American president of the last 50 years, Simon Jenkins, journalist and columnist for The Guardian. Simon Jenkins.
I would just point out about Iraq. You cannot say something's a success when, as I saw last week, 2 million Iraqis are camped outside Damascus because they haven't got the nerve to go home to their homeland because the Americans are there. Two-thirds of all the Christians in Iraq have now been driven out of that country under America's aegis. However, let me come back to the original point. I had great respect for Bush when he came to power. I liked his courtesy, I liked his moderation, and I liked his concept of humility in America's power projection. I think, tragically, after 9/11, he allowed the politics of fear to get the better of him. The politics of fear is the most corrosive of all forms of politics in a democracy. If you're the most powerful country in the world, your obligation is not to go over the top, charge around the world, invading countries on the feeblest of pretexts. Your obligation is to show restraint. I personally think that you've just elected a man who I've found from when I first read his book, a truly remarkable figure, on whom I think it is right to place great expectations. But he has got to recover from a terrible legacy in the world outside America. I still believe he will. I think you have a terrific future ahead of you, but you have been through an awful 8 years. Thank you very much.
Let's remember where we are. We have heard the debates, we have heard the arguments, and we have heard from you when you came into this debate. Well, we tend to judge who is the winner by who moved most positions. And in that case, I'll give you the numbers in a second, but the bottom line is that those against the motion changed more minds tonight than those for the motion. Before the debate, 65% were for the motion, 17% against, and 18% undecided. After the debate, 68% were for the motion, 27% are against the motion, and 5% remain undecided. Congratulations to all of our panelists. Congratulations to you. And thank you for joining us at this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. To hear the full unedited version or to sign up for the Intelligence Squared podcast, visit npr.org/intelligencesquared. Robert Rosenkranz is chairman. Dana Wolf is executive producer. Maureen McMurray and Rob Christensen are the radio producers. Damon Whitmore is the audio engineer. And I'm your host, John Donvan.
For more information or to purchase tickets to future events, visit www.intelligencesquaredus.org. Intelligence Squared is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.